Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Charlotte Lomas in Bonn. On today's show, combating coral decline in the Maldives. Also coming up, Romania's small farms come under threat.
Lots of chemicals invaded Romania and so on. And we also realize that small-scale farmers are in a big threat to be swept away by this development of the huge corporations. The small-scale farmers know what to do for themselves, but they are discouraged to do that.
And Rome's tradition of eel fishing nears an end.
Anguilla che succede con la depurazione che fanno?
They are hard to find these days because their habitat has disappeared.
All this and more here on Living Planet. But first, it's one of the must-have photographs when visiting London, standing in front of one of the city's red telephone boxes. But in the age of mobile phones, most of London's telephone boxes have seen better days. An estimated 8,000 of the iconic red symbols of the UK's capital are completely unused. But now, these phone boxes are getting a second life with the help of a green makeover. It's called the Solar Box, a bright green, free-to-use, solar-powered charging station for mobile phones and other gadgets. It's been used by locals, photographed by tourists, and has been praised as the kind of startup that will keep London at the forefront of future technology. Anya Coopers has the story.
It's a blustery autumn day in London's busy city centre. Big red buses carry hordes of shoppers up and down the congested thoroughfares of Oxford Street and Tottenham Court Road. And there, standing still in amongst the crowded rush of pedestrians, with faces glued to their phones, is one of London's famous red phone boxes. Only this one's got an unusual flair.
We've actually taken something that's really iconic and said, hey, actually, we can do really cool stuff with that. So what we did was we got the red telephone box. So it was completely stripped. So paint was stripped and gutted from the inside. And then we basically got an engineer on board, because Howard and I aren't technical. We have geography degrees from LSE, to build the system for us.
The Solar Box is London's very first and so far only solar-powered, bright green smartphone charging station. University students Kirsty Kenny and Harold Craston came up with the idea of the Solar Box, which Kirsty says is much more than just about saving the iconic red phone box from redundancy.
This has always been about public space and how we can reclaim public spaces and make them, you know, for the public again. You know, this is essentially provision of power as a public good, and that's, you know, that's the key motivation behind this. And the fact that we can do that in an environmentally friendly way is amazing.
Their concept is just the kind of green initiative that London needs to achieve its goal of becoming the world's greener city by 2020. With a custom-made rooftop solar panel, the Solar Box can charge different gadgets, including smartphones, tablets and cameras. And it's free to use. The creators won £5,000 in this year's Mayor of London Low Carbon Prize competition, a student competition encouraging ideas to reduce London's energy use and carbon emissions. Matthew Penchart, the Mayor's Environment and Energy Advisor and one of the competition judges, says he wants to see solar boxes become part of the London landscape.
I think we were particularly taken with the way that Solar Box put forward an idea which was going to sort of rejuvenate, I suppose, a iconic bit of London's urban street scene and turn it into a sort of symbol for a transferring to a sort of low-carbon economy. Because I mean, I wonder how many phone calls are made out of a red telephone box these days. They'd probably get a lot more use as a solar box.
But even if all of the city's red phone boxes were given a green makeover, are Londoners actually going to use solar boxes? Matt McCoughlin lives in London and says it's what the city has needed for a long time.
Hi, can I just ask you a quick question about the solar box? Have you heard of it?
It's a place to charge your phone, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's great, and it's obviously using solar power to do it. I think it's great, especially with an iPhone, because the batteries just run down so much. It's like you're out in the middle of the day and suddenly you've got no battery, no communication or anything.
Fellow Londoner Philip Wilson had no idea what the solar box was, but said he might use it depending on the time of day and the weather.
Is that something that you would use?
Probably, yes, because my phone, yeah, because the battery life on smartphones isn't good enough. Yeah. I think they should put things like that, though, in coffee shops as well, because I'm not really going to stand around with inclement British weather, either inside or outside, getting rained on.
So although not yet famous amongst Londoners, it is estimated that around 60 to 80 people are using it every day. But are initiatives like these, partly funded by the Mayor's Office, actually making the capital city greener? London may be aiming for greener city by 2020, but it still has a long way to go. Air quality in London is among the worst in Europe, and just recently Oxford Street was said to have some of the world's highest recorded levels of nitrogen dioxide, a toxic pollutant that can trigger asthma and heart attacks. Jenny Bates from environmental group Friends of the Earth is sceptical.
The Mayor's Office, you know, has got several good initiatives, and having competitions like that can only be good. But the bigger picture is that he's failing on his own targets for cutting climate-changing emissions, and that's a real problem. So much more needs to be done. You know, things are happening, but just not strong enough, not fast enough.
Mayor Boris Johnson's environment and energy adviser, Matthew Penchartz, defended the mayor's initiatives, saying London is on track to become the world's greenest city by 2020.
No other city in the world, arguably, is doing anything close to the amount of action the mayor is taking. Now, it's fair enough for people to say you've got to do more, but in my view, they should put that in the context of nobody else is doing as much as this. Nobody else has proposed an ultra-low emission zone. We have the cleanest large bus fleet in the world. We are the only city in the world to bring forward regulation to try and clean up the construction equipment. We are bringing forward a regulation on new taxis in due course. Nobody else has this sort of suite of measures.
And what about Kirsty Kenny, the co-creator of the solar box? Well, she thinks London could try harder.
How green is London? Well, it's not green enough yet, but I think it's going in the right direction.
With just one solar box in London so far, its creators want to see another 10 green boxes rolled out by 2015 and several placed in London's tube stations by 2016. But first, they need to find investors. For now, the solar box on Tottenham Court Road is giving London's iconic phone box a new green face and giving Londoners a taste of some free solar energy. Anya Coopers, DW, London.
Rome is known for its extravagant deli food. Eels fished from the local Tiber River are a traditional delicacy. Prepared with peas and tomato sauce or simply served fried, eel was often eaten at Christmas or New Year. In post-war Italy, eels were plentiful and dozens of fishermen would fish eels at the Tiber. But since the 1970s, eels have started disappearing. Angelo Fonsreg has more from Rome.
The Bergamini brothers are the last eel catchers on the Tiber River. Every morning, Cesare Bergamini, 74, chain-smoking, donning jeans, rubber boots and a red cap, sets out to check up on his 250-odd traps he's fixed the night before. Fishing for these brothers is a family tradition, explains Cesare.
This is our zona nostra di pesca, diciamo, da qua.
This is our fishing ground. It reaches 8 kilometers downstream. I've been catching eels on the Tiber River since 1947. I started fishing together with my grandfather. He had a boat in Testaccio. But those were different times.
Back then, the river was full of eels, and his family made a good living selling them. Today, no one wants to do this job anymore. Bergamini steers his battered red dinghy towards pipes that discard sewage water into the river.
It's hard to find eel. The acid in the wastewater burns the worms and the snails. Down there, everything is burnt. The eel, the tench, the catfish. They are hard to find these days because their habitat has disappeared.
Giuseppe Amendola is chairman of Amici del Tevere, an organization that tries to protect Italy's third largest river. He explains the state of the Tiber River.
The color of the water is not very inviting. Historically, it's called the blonde Tiber. But the color is not the thing to worry about. It's the biochemical state to be worried about. The river is not very healthy.
About 75% of the water samples taken in the Lazio region have contained concentrations of bacteria above the legally accepted level, according to a survey by the environmental organization Legambiente. Amendola says the state of the river is far from ideal, but much better than it was 20 years ago.
The situation is not really bad. The last decades, the laws on depuration and dumping have become more strict, so we're much better off today than we were in the 1970s and 80s. But there are still thousands of households that dump unfiltered sewage into the river. So on a biological, bacterial level, the health situation is not very good, but the chemical situation is, as there are no large industries along the river.
I've been fishing with the Bergamini brothers, the last two eel catches in Rome. These eels taken from the Tiber River, are they edible?
Yes, they are. You have to leave them alive in clean water for 1 or 2 days to purify them.
In the neighborhood of Monte Mario, northwest part of Rome, and I wander through the local markets in search of eel. Most of the stands here sell fruit and vegetables, but there are also a couple of fishmongers. One of them is here every day. He sells squid, sea bass, plaice and sardines. But does he have any eel?
Buongiorno. C'è la anguilla.
No, niente anguilla.
No, non c'è.
Non c'è.
No, I don't have any eel, he says. There's a woman here near the fishmonger stand. Would you eat any Tiber eel?
No.
Perché no?
Perché è troppo inquinato.
Sicura?
No, però vederlo non ispira.
No, she says, I wouldn't because the river is too polluted. Eel is hard to find on the local markets, but it's not impossible.
Le anguille arrivano fra 15 giorni sicuramente. Il periodo del natalizio.
Yes, we have eel, but only in the Christmas period, because they're a traditional Christmas dish. They come from the Tiber River, but they're not wild animals. They're bred in a side canal of the river.
Non è roba dei mari. L'anguilla non esiste proprio dei mari.
Nonetheless, the profession of eel catching remains under threat. In the 1950s and 60s, Bergamini got around 600 lire per kilo, which would be 8 euros today. He still makes 7 to 9 euros per kilo, but the number of eels in the Tiber River has declined. For Cesare Bergamini, it's just enough to survive. He and his brother are the last remaining eel catchers in Rome.
Finiti noi, è finita sta storia.
This story will end with us. I'm not going to retire. My retirement is here on the river. There's no better place to be than here on the river.
Angelo von Schaik, DW, Rome, Italy.
The Maldives, a small island nation in the Indian Ocean, is a major tourist hotspot. But its coral reefs, like many reefs around the world, are under threat. In the Maldives, international organisations are handing over responsibility of reef checks to local divers to help monitor the health of coral reefs. Earlier I spoke to Matthias Hammer, Director of Biosphere Expeditions, who began by explaining how reef checks can help map coral decline.
Well, because the reefs are in crisis, really, all over the world. And until Reef Check was introduced, I think, in the 80s, there was really no consensus on whether reefs were doing well or not amongst scientists. And now we have a methodology that's applied all over the world, and then you can compare regions all over the world. And basically, the answer is, well, reefs are really in crisis. But that's only a recent finding.
What's involved in a reef check exactly?
It's a methodology that's based on lay people involvement. So all you need to be able to do is dive. So you need to have a dive qualification, and then you're trained for 2 days to recognize indicator species. So these are species that are relatively easy to recognize. So a lobster, for example, and they indicate certain things. An absence of lobsters indicates overfishing, and everyone can recognize a lobster, for example. So then you put a team together, usually 6 or 8. You lay a line underwater 100 meters, and you dive along that line, and then in pairs of 2, you record fish, invertebrates, substrate, and then that all gets put into a data sheet, and that gives you a snapshot of the health of the reef. The advantage is that, you know, we want locals taking care of their local reefs rather than, you know, experts coming in from the outside telling locals what to do. And in the absence of any real interest of the government, which is really amazing in reef conservation, because after all, the Maldives, I mean, they are based on the reefs, their whole livelihoods, the country itself. It wouldn't be there without the reefs. But if the government's not going to do it, civil society will have to do it, and that's just what's happening. So we're building capacity, and we're letting local people get on with protecting their local reefs.
What are the major threats to reef ecosystems?
The two biggest threats for reefs is acidification. So with global warming, the acid content in the water is likely to rise, and the reefs, or the polyps of the corals, can only tolerate certain acidity. So that's one big problem. The other one is just the water is getting too warm. So how resilient they are, well, we really don't know.
So what state are the reefs of the Maldives in at the moment?
It depends on where you are. You know, it's always the same story with reefs or with other wildlife. The closer you are to humans, the worse they come off. So around the central atolls, there are good bits, but there are also bad bits, and the bad bits are often where near human habitations. So the further away you get from the human centres, the better the reefs are. Even if they're away from humans, they're still suffering from human-induced impacts such as higher water temperature and high salinity and acidification. Overfishing is another one, especially in close to human habitation. There's too much fishing going on of the food fish, and you know, it's all connected. So if you fish out the food fish that keep the algae down, then the algae will come up. The algae will overwhelm the coral, so the coral reef dies, and you get a phase change from a coral reef to, you know, an algal reef.
And what is at stake?
There's lots at stake. What kind of reef do we want to pass on? Do we want to keep biodiversity, one, for the sake of biodiversity, because that's what we want to pass on to our children? And then also there's the arguments that, you know, there's this wealth, there's these ecosystem services. Yeah? So, for example, there might be new compounds in medical research that are yet to be discovered, and that might make a big difference, and they come from the reef. You know, they're also acting as breakwaters, protecting us from wave currents, etc. So, you know, all these things are important for, as a basis for, especially in the Maldives, the livelihoods of people.
Biosphere Expeditions has just handed over the responsibility of reef checks on the Maldives reefs to local divers. Why is this important?
We run an annual reef survey in the Maldives every year, and we have done, I think, since 2010. And on each of those surveys, we have a placement program with locals, training them to do their own surveys. And now this reef check that's just been happened is the first time that the local people have done it themselves. So, you know, it's a community-based survey program, and the significance is really that's what the Maldives need.
What sort of action is being taken to maintain the health of the Maldivian reefs at the moment, and what else needs to happen?
You know, the Maldives are, in a sense, they're quite good because they're declaring marine protected areas And there is a plan that the president has announced that he wants to make the entire Maldives a marine protected area. Now, that's good, but if it's only a paper park, then it's no good. And a paper park is you declare something, but there's no enforcement of it, or, you know, no buy-in from the local people. So what we really need is buy-in from the local people and government action. We conservationists say is what pays stays. So if people realize that actually, and many fishermen don't, because they just lack the education, or, you know, they can't dive and they don't understand the connection between the fish coming out of the sea, and then if you overfish, then there won't be any fish left. So these kind of locally based initiatives is really, really important, because if we don't have local buy-in, then nothing happens.
That was Matthias Hammer, the director of Biosphere Expeditions. Romania is a country of small-scale farmers. Their soft, respectful way of farming has helped maintain a diverse natural environment unparalleled in the EU. About a third of Romania's 19 million population continues to live off subsistence and semi-subsistence farms. But their way of life is under threat, and many Romanians feel these small-scale farmers have now been left in the lurch. From there, Christian Cummins reports.
This is the dawn chorus on a hill above the village of Stejerișu in Transylvania. At sunrise, a drover has herded his cows up from the village, and the new arrivals on the mountain pastureland have excited the guardian dogs protecting a flock of sheep from wolves. It's a scene underlining the beautiful interaction between man and nature. Gabriela Mindru, who runs a rural support program called Village Life, says Romania's farmers represent values to be proud of.
I think the most valuable things are the self-sufficient lifestyle they lead, meaning that they grow their own food. Everything that they use in their household is made by them. Some even make their own clothes and furniture. And the second thing that is really valuable is their relationship with nature and animals and everything around them, the forest, the rivers and all that. I think that contributes a lot to the well-being of people.
However, this traditional way of life is under threat because Romania is at a development crossroads. 45% of the country's population lives in rural areas. Many still get around by horse and cart. But these communities have been depleted in recent years by economic migration. Many have moved to the cities in search of better-paying jobs, or even abroad since Romania's entry into the EU in 2007. So a whole generation is missing from the villages.
You'll probably see how most of the people are over 50, let's say, and there are a few young people that are in high school or in school, but their plans are to leave the village as well.
There is also a crisis of confidence. In a cafe in the Transylvanian town of Sibiu, I meet a blogger called Juana Maria. She says the strong culture of the rural population has been eroded by negative attitudes towards their way of life.
They have been taught that everything that they do in the countryside is bad. And then when they come to town for finishing their high schools, let's say, they completely do away with everything that they've been brought up with.
To understand the pressures causing rural depopulation, I drive to a village called Sashis to meet Anca Dalmaso at her small farm. She's one of the younger generation who has stayed, helping fund her rural lifestyle by marketing quality homemade regional products. But she knows she could earn more if she moved away.
The temptations are so big, and every single day we have this kind of challenges. We choose a way of life, actually. It is about finding a balance. It is about enjoying life. It is about resisting this temptation.
You want a challenge? This is Willy Schuster doing the evening milking round on his small organic farm. He believes the European Union should support this rural lifestyle. After all, he points out, one of the European Union's slogans is unity in diversity. But instead, he says, Brussels seems happy to see market forces wipe out small-scale farmers. 70% of Romanian farms are considered ineligible for subsidies of any kind because they're too small. Schuster has watched the developments of the past decade with consternation.
Lots of chemicals invaded Romania and so on. And we also realize that small-scale farmers are in a big threat to be swept away by this development of the huge corporations. Our feeling was that the small-scale farmers know what to do for themselves, but they are discouraged to do that, and they are being mobbed out.
Pia Brotstrager, a young Austrian woman, is cutting the grass by hand for hay in the small village of Visișoara. She moved there, she says, because she wanted to understand the Romanian countryside. Pia is concerned about the onward march of the big corporations, but she also worries about romanticising the Romanian countryside.
As I talk to the people, they also really want more luxury and development. And as I found out, for me, I can come here, I can enjoy the old way of living. However, those people always have it like that. A woman over there doesn't have a bathroom. They always wash themselves outside. So, as I said, for me, I can enjoy it, but I can always go home to my luxury, you know, people here not.
But Willy Schuster's organic farm is proof that old and new can be combined. He's a forward-looking man who uses social media to communicate his ideas, and he's a farmer by choice.
We strongly believed that organic is the solution for Romania because there is such a huge biodiversity. And at that time, in 1999, when I started farming, it still was very, very clean. Very little chemicals were used.
Willy fears industrial farming is changing all that, and that could have a negative impact on certain products. In autumn, the hills are strewn with purple and blue wild flowers, and nomadic beekeepers move their colourful box hives around the country. The honey produced by small-scale farmers in Transylvania wins prizes, and Anca Dalmaso thinks she knows why.
I think that biodiversity, the fact that we still have such a variety of flowers, you know, the quality of honey is coming from the quality of the flowers. So that's the secret. Keep the biodiversity and you will have good quality products.
In the end, surely the quality of the product will be the key to the survival of small-scale farmers in Romania. For Anca, it's not about a blinkered nostalgia. It's about choice. And it's about a future where diversity is valued.
Again, it is about balance. We are not fighting against something. We do understand as new generation that we have to have a little bit of everything. What we are asking is just to leave us exist and to give the alternative of the consumers.
Christian Cummins, DW, Transylvania.
That's it for this edition of Living Planet. Don't forget you can download episodes or replay them online at dw.de/environment. You can also find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. We'll be back again next week for more news and stories about the environment. Until then, from all of us in the studio here in Bonn, thanks for listening.
To create a dawn.